Hi, everybody. It's Bill and Wendy. Welcome to the show. Happy Martin Luther King Day to everybody. We will discuss Martin Luther King in about a half an hour.
All right. Good with me.
Did you have a nice weekend?
I did. A lot of shoveling, soup making. Yeah.
It was, this weekend was 50% snow and 50% football for some of us. I know that there are some people.
I didn't watch a lick of it. Who's going to the Super Bowl?
It was, your New England Patriots who are there.
Why'd they
every
even
time
play?
They have a Super Bowl.
I know.
The New England Patriots are there. A credit to Tom Brady and the always jovial Bill Belichick, who just has the biggest smile on his face at all time. At some point, Alan Arkin said, "Hey, lighten up a little bit. Why can't you smile?" It's so weird because I know that it's a football game and it's gritty. I mean, there's guys pushing and shoving and stuff like that. But they show Belichick and he just looks so miserable under good conditions, bad conditions. It's just different, varying degrees of miserable. Wouldn't you have some fun? Like if,
but he's smiling on the inside.
He's always smiling on the inside. But
aren't we all?
If I said to you, Wendy, you have an NFL team that you coach, and you'll go to the Super Bowl kind of every year. We'll get your team in the Super Bowl every year. Wouldn't you go, oh, that's great. Look what's on my face, a smile. He just doesn't have it. And maybe that's maybe for a coach, maybe that's better. Maybe.
You'd be making fun of him if all he did was smile
all the time.
I would be like, what's wrong with him?
If he smiled all the time, yes. But if he smiled, like, the game was over. They won the game. They won a very exciting game in overtime. Cut to Bill Belichick. Smile. Have a good time.
What was Tom Brady doing?
Smiling.
I'm sick of him.
Smiling back. But
why do so many people hate him?
I can't figure that out.
Is it just because he wins?
He's got everything going, David. I mean,
but is
really
that a reason to hate a guy?
Occasionally. Yes.
I
mean, come on.
I admire
you
that.
You usually hate people that have everything going on.
I hate people who are cocky without having
the backup,
the reason to be cocky. Yeah. And he is cocky, but boy, does
he
back it up.
He walks the walk.
He just keeps...
Blah, blah, blah.
I had a conversation with one of my daughters last week because Gwyneth Paltrow was on Ellen. And my daughter says, oh, I can't stand her. I go, you don't like Gwyneth Paltrow? So it's she and Anne Hathaway who like Tom Brady, just have this ability to be hated by people for no real reason.
They're irritating.
Because why? Why are they so irritating?
Well, Anne Hathaway won me over when she was Catwoman. I thought she was really good.
Yeah. But that's about the time, that was right around the time people turned on her. Like when she first started showing up in movies, people go, oh, isn't she delightful? And then all of a sudden people go, nah, I don't like her anymore.
I think it was her Les Mis thing.
That's what it was. But
made who said she was delightful? I never really saw it.
Miserable on Les Miserables.
That's the name.
But that was, Les Mis was right around the time that people went, oh, and she can sing? Oh, great.
Yeah.
Another skill for her? Blah.
She does not stand out to me for anything.
You don't think she's pretty or a good actress or anything?
Yeah. You don't like The Princess Diaries?
I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
Julie Andrews, she is in it.
Yeah,
that's why Wendy won't see it.
Listen, I don't have a problem with Julie Andrews. It just so happens that I'm the only person alive who hasn't seen The Sound of Music.
Right.
So why should I see it now?
Or Mary Poppins. Or any movie Julie Andrews has been in except for
Victoria.
Victor Victoria is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
Cut his mic.
That was the worst movie I've ever seen.
I thought it was funnier than hell.
Even you didn't like it?
No, I couldn't stand it. Blake, I told you this about Blake Edwards. When he was working with Peter Sellers, he was incredibly gifted and talented. Other than that, not at all.
Yeah, I really don't have a problem with Julie Andrews. I just never saw those movies. And I've lived to tell.
I know. So Sound of Music just happened to be, you've got a night with nothing to do, you turn on the TV, and it's just starting up. Julie's twirling around the mountaintop.
The hills are
in her
alive.
Apron. You wouldn't watch any of it?
Now I probably would. No, I wouldn't.
No?
I got to tell you, I got so much other stuff to watch.
Oh.
And it's really long. It's one of my favorite movies, but it's very long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm out.
That was back when they had intermissions at the movie theater.
They did.
Yeah. You could go out to the lobby.
Did you ever see a movie that had an intermission? I thought that was...
Yes, I did. At the Olympic Theater in Cicero. The old-time, beautiful theater with the lovely...
Very ornate.
Yes, and the curtains would come down where they were opaque so you could kind of see through it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do remember that. I don't remember what movie it was.
That was such a weird thing. Like now, I don't think they would do that, but I remember seeing Oliver, and there was a 20-minute intermission in the middle of Oliver.
Oh, Oliver was long. Whoa.
Which was just their way of saying... Hey, we've got snow caps, we got razzles, we got right. milk duds.
No, it was their way of saying, we know that you're bored to death.
No, Oliver
okay,
was great.
Come on out and spend some more money.
They had to change the film, you know.
Yeah, they
the
would put
the
a
back.
There was a giant reel, but they...
Oh, yes.
So they had to take the big spool off and put another spool
right.
on.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had to rewind it, or they'd get charged.
Have you ever been? Have you ever been in one of the older theater booths?
Yes.
Booths? No.
I had the chance to go in and actually run a film. It was it's a weird experience.
Do but they still run
it's
them?
Done differently.
Yeah, it's very different now. The old projectors had a little, you had an arc, sort of an arc light thing for the light.
Yeah.
And then you had the, using two machines, you had the motor cue on the upper right hand a corner of the frame.
Right.
And then the second, few seconds later, there'd be the changeover cue.
Yeah.
So it was, I got a chance to try it and I got
it's not
it right.
easy.
Yeah, it's not easy.
It's not easy.
Were you
it
in AV
skill.
Club when you were in high school?
Not exactly.
Getting to wheel the projector from room to room?
I took electrical and electronics engineering in high school.
Oh, okay. So.
I know I'm not remembering this quite properly, but it seemed like when I was in grade school, I would say 90% of the time when they showed a film in class, it would burn up at some point during the presentation.
Yes.
I know I'm imagining
the bulb was
that.
Too
it
hot.
Can't be that often.
It wasn't.
But it seems
but
like every time they'd be
the
showing
old eight
us.
The old 8 millimeters or the 8 millimeter?
The
right?
8 millimeter films. Yeah, they would show them and they'd say, Rome, one of the most beautiful countries in the world. And then all of a sudden, it would just burn up and the kids would applaud. Everybody was very polite about it. We would all applaud.
The teacher would look flustered.
Teacher would be furious.
And then it would take another 15 minutes for them to fix it,
right.
which is great. You
right.
just sit there.
Remember they used to wheel in those really old TVs?
Yes.
Yes. With a giant VCR attached to it?
You had the TV-VCR combination that took two kids. One kid couldn't, you'd get a hernia.
Right.
There's no way one kid could bring
it's
that
It's on
in.
Wheels.
You had the 8mm films, and then you also had overhead projector presentations. That
I
was
hated
fun.
Those.
That thing was gigantic too.
Yeah. the days of school.
And now, I mean, look at what it is. What it's like now. My kid, you know, I'd go to parent-teacher days where they would show me PowerPoint presentations in every classroom that were just stunning. But you know, it's a generation later. We must take a break.
Can I read two texts really quickly?
Please.
I am a woman. Says 847. I've never seen Sound of Music or Mary Poppins either. They don't appeal to me at all. Seem silly and boring. 630, tell Wendy I never saw Sound of Music or Mary Poppins and I turned out okay.
Do you think that there's a branch of citizens who just automatically avoid anything Julie Andrews?
No.
Is that what it is?
Another one, haven't watched Sound of Music either.
I don't know how you can avoid seeing Sound of Music. It seems like it's on all the time. It seems like it's always on television.
I have a remote.
Do you get an alert on your phone?
Yes.
And Sound of Music is starting. Avoid channel 9.
Right.
Oh, no.
224, plain and simply, Tom Brady is a cheater.
A
little bit.
Yeah. I mean, there was the one instance.
That's a big one instance.
Yeah. But he paid the price. I mean, he did his time. He did his crime. He did his time.
Thank you, Beretta.
He's back in it. All right, we must take a break. There's a lot more show coming. If you want to reach us, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and it's Wendy on WGN.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It is Martin Luther King Day. And getting in a ton more texts. I'm 70 and I haven't seen Mary Poppins or
Sound of Music. I'm very surprised.
And wondering if I saw Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I did. I loved.
Well, she's not
in
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Dr. Doolittle, I saw that.
She's not in that at all.
I'm just getting random questions.
just every movie in the world. Is she in the Boatniks? No, she is not in the Boatniks. Why would you ask that? She's still, I mean, I can't remember the last time she was in a movie. It's been a long time. Is that why you're staying away from movie theaters? Is it for fear that Julie Andrews will pop up in a film?
I don't really have a problem with her.
No.
I just never saw it, and
now you've given up on it.
Well, I mean,
why bother now?
Yeah. It's not like I've been dying to see it, and Mary just said it's super long, so...
It is.
Anybody avoid A Christmas Story?
You
can't. The Gene Shepard one?
You can't.
No, that's great.
Yes, you can.
What, you don't like that?
Please.
Well, I love Gene Shepard.
Yeah.
I'm just not a big fan of the movie.
I loved
listening to Shepard when he was still alive and doing radio.
Great voice.
Oh, it was an amazing storyteller.
David Jennings?
Yeah,
yes,
David also has
a great voice.
Yep.
Both of them. I'm not a storyteller like Gene Shepard.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Absolutely.
That was from a short story that he had published in Playboy magazine originally. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Christmas story?
Julie Andrews was a voice in Aquaman and Despicable Me 3.
In the Aquaman that's out right
2018.
Now? Oh, I didn't know that. Who is she the voice of? Does it say?
Carathon.
Oh, yeah.
And...
His wacky neighbor. Aquaman's wacky neighbor. Can I borrow some plankton? Carathon. That's my favorite scene in Aquaman.
Shrek the Third. She was the queen.
Oh, I did know that. And you probably didn't see that.
I didn't.
No?
I liked the original.
Is Julie Andrews... I picture you as you're purchasing tickets at a movie theater. Is Julie Andrews in this at all? No, she's not, ma'am. All right, then I will see it. I will gladly see your movie then. Strange news from Fox and Friends this morning as they announced early in their program. Well, they didn't announce that she had died, but they put up a graphic on Fox and Friends with a picture of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It says on the graphic, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then underneath that, it says 1933-2019.
Uh-oh.
Which would lead you to believe
that she has passed on.
That she has expired. However, she has not. And they're apologizing. Fox and Friends apologized on Monday after airing a graphic that incorrectly implied, I would say it implied. What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, what else would you think?
And it's not just a picture of her. It's a picture of her that you would use if she died. You know, there's always that version that looks kind of introspective and
yeah.
Like
I don't have a picture, so I will never die. No picture like that.
You almost have to have that on file. Somebody has to keep that picture in case the worst happens. So they go, use the expired picture. You know the one. They apologized for airing a graphic that incorrectly implied that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died, blaming the mix-up on a technical error.
Well, duh. But now what did they say? What was, you know, the graphic was up. Were they saying our condolences?
It's really weird because when they came back, they didn't do a segment on it. Like, if she had died, you would show that graphic and then you would talk about her legacy.
Yes.
But instead, they cut to an interview that had to do with what's going on college campuses today. Campus culture. Which is even more confusing. But if you're in a... All right, you know how in the morning you're kind of in a hurry, you're getting dressed, you're getting breakfast ready, you're finding things that you need to take with you? So for a lot of people, if they had that on, they looked over and they go, oh, she's obviously no longer with us. There's her face. She looks sad. There's the birth date. There's the death date.
Yeah, when you see the dates with the hyphen in the middle, that indicates death. There's no other way around it.
Who was the sports celebrity... I want to say this is Ted Williams. I'm almost positive this was Ted Williams that was watching one of the morning shows and that they had announced that he had died. And then he called family members to find out if that had happened.
It was very what a upset. Great sense of humor.
I'm watching the Today Show. They announced my death. Did that happen? Did I sleep through that? What happened? I'm almost positive it was Ted Williams.
That's pretty funny.
Later in the show, oh, I'm sorry, it says the image showed the dates, 1933 to 2009, under Ginsburg's name, and next to her portrait. It flashed on screen for a few moments. I bet they're exaggerating that. Probably a few seconds, right? Before cutting to host Ainsley Earhart's interview with a college professor as they discussed campus culture. Later in the show, the hosts acknowledged the error by saying, we need to apologize, this according to Steve Ducey, one of the hosts of Fox and Friends, a technical error in the control room triggered a graphic of Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a date on it. Now, I hope people know this. If you don't, you'll know this now. When celebrities reach a certain age, or if they're ill, the news services prepare an obituary. They have it ready. They have the pictures ready. sometimes they'll have a whole package ready of what that person has achieved so that when they die, it's ready to run.
You've heard of a press kit. This is a death kit.
It is.
It kind of is.
It is. It definitely is.
And they're written up and ready on a whole lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Wonder what mine says.
Never saw a Julie Andrews movie.
That's not true. I did.
They'll show footage.
That's funny.
That'll be the headline on the obituary. She never saw a Julie Andrews film.
I saw
film.
Victor Victoria, so that's inaccurate.
Only saw one Julie Andrews movie. And then they'll talk to Julie for comment about your death, and she'll go, I can't, it's too soon. I can't say anything yet. We need to apologize, said Steve Doocy. A technical error in the control room triggered a graphic of Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a date on it. We don't, and that's, for me, that's the telltale sign of a person is gone.
Yep.
Because you know, normally if there's a person's picture on your TV, it doesn't just have their birth date, like the day they were born, and then a dash, and then nothing. You only see dates if that person has expired, right? We don't want to make it seem anything other than it was a mistake. That was an accident. We believe she is still at home recovering from surgery.
We believe.
Big mistake. I know. He's still leaving like a little, like a slight open door. Like, it's possible. No, I haven't talked to her today.
The non-apology apology.
Right. Which has become very much in vogue lately.
Yeah, that is the apology now.
We believe that she is still at home recovering from surgery. Big mistake. We apologize, Earnhardt reiterated. It was a big mistake. Ginsburg, aged 85, underwent a pulmonary lobectomy for two malignant growths on her lung just last month. She continues to recover from surgery, which was dubbed a success. And there's a movie coming out about her, I think, this week, right?
Yeah.
Is it Friday?
I almost thought it was released already. Who's in that one? Some superstars.
There was just, that was, you may be thinking about the CNN thing.
No.
Because that's already been around. And I can't remember the name of the actress who plays her in the full movie. Short. What is the name? I can't remember it.
What does it say?
I'm waiting for my.
So there's more than one movie.
It's on the basis of sex. That's the movie.
Right. It looks good because there's been a documentary or two about her.
RBG was one of them.
That was last year.
Oh, that was what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I've heard really good things. No, this is a dramatization. Completely Julie Andrews free, Wendy. You're wide open to see
Felicity,
this.
Felicity Jones.
On the basis of sex.
Felicity Jones. That's the movie.
Yeah.
She's the star. She plays her.
Wow.
And it looks like it was her life during probably the 60s or the 70s, right?
It was when she was, I think, the case she argued before the then Supreme Court on women's rights.
So yeah. That was the 70s.
Her struggles for equal rights and what she had to overcome in order to become a female U.S. Supreme Court justice.
Ah, it looks good. It looks good. All right. So, again, we accept the apology from Fox and Friends or not.
Well, of course. Make mistakes.
You're not going to get any more detailed or better apology than
probably
what
not.
They've given.
I like they leave the wiggle room in case it is in fact true.
We haven't talked to her today. We don't think she died.
It's just sad coming out of her medical situation to hear that.
That should be a daily segment on the show. Is they
considering
should
her sense of humor? If she was at home watching, she probably chuckled and went, "Hmm,
I won
really?
This one. Yeah, I'm still here."
I'll be at the court tomorrow morning, bright and early at 7 o'clock.
See you there.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it. We shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. We
shall overcome. I am covered in goosebumps listening to that, aren't you?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
People across Illinois are honoring Martin Luther King Jr. with service projects, celebrations. Something I just learned that is fascinating. In 1973, Illinois was the first state to declare his birthday a holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to do some learning this morning. Vice President for Interpretation and Education at the Chicago History Museum, John Russick, is with us. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a great day. It's a beautiful day outside. A little snowy, but that's appropriate for this time of year.
Did you also get goosebumps listening to that speech?
Always.
Every time.
Every time. It's amazing how there are a few speeches that do that, right? You listen to them, and they don't get old, and I think that's partly because they speak eternal truths, right? They're about the kind of people we want to be and the kind of country we want to be part of and the way we want to think about other people, we want them to think about us.
John, I know this is purely speculation, but I would love to hear your answer. What do you think Dr. King would think about what's going on in the country today?
Well, you know, it's interesting to speculate, of course. Obviously, none of us know what Dr. King would have thought, and probably none of us actually would have the nerve to say we knew what he thought back then other than what he said. But obviously, you know, he was working in a time of great confusion and change in America in the 50s and the 60s. If you think about what he was experiencing and what he was fighting for, I'm sure the logic that he brought to his argument, right, of equality and fairness, that all people are created equal, it all must have seemed to some degree so obvious that they were themes and ideals that had been set in motion in the late 18th century. Why are we still fighting over them in the 1900s? I don't know that the tenor of our time would feel quite so different to him. At the same time, I think he would have hoped that we'd be further along in our progress by now.
All Chicago public schools are not in session today in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. I feel kids should go to school on this day and learn about him. But if not, they could go to the Chicago History Museum, correct?
That's right. That's right. That's what we're here for. We are hoping to have everybody sort of take a break from the everyday and not just get a little Dr. King in maybe one class or two classes throughout the day. You can come to the History Museum and really immerse yourself in the history of King in the past, his ideas in the present, and forcing us to think a little bit about what King might want us to do moving forward. And we have programs here, we have exhibits here, we have lots of opportunities for people to engage with his ideas and his sacrifice and really revitalize what he stood for and what he was hoping we could all stand for if we stood together.
John, historians are in huge agreement that the I Had a Dream speech is one of the most monumental speeches of all time. Tell us a little bit about the background of that speech. Did he write it by himself, or did he have people helping him craft that speech?
You know, it's interesting. The story that I think really got a lot of exposure in the last couple of years is about how Dr. King had sort of talked about his dream in different circles with different people before that speech. This idea of the view from the mountaintop, the sense of the kind of country he hoped America would be in the future. And the story, as it's come to be known, is that in more recent times, is that perhaps Mahalia Jackson, perhaps other people who were there that day, heard Dr. King giving the speech that had been prepared, and shouted out at some point, or whispered to him, or made some call to him, to tell the audience about his dream, and that was, while it wasn't something that was generated on the spot, it hadn't been necessarily part of his plan for the speech that day, and that he had in that sort of spontaneous moment to talk about what he imagined America could be and what a world where we're judged by the content of our character could look like, Yeah, he reshaped American discourse, really. I mean, the fact that here we are more than 50 years later still talking about that speech and the power and the impact of it is pretty remarkable when you think about the possibility that maybe it wasn't always part of the agenda for that day, that maybe it was something that was brought to his lips at the suggestion of people who were near him then, because they had been affected by his idea and his vision of for the America of the future.
And now there will be a reenactment this afternoon at the Chicago History Museum. All the information is at chicagohistory.org. We're talking with John Russick, Vice President for Interpretation and Education at the Chicago History Museum. David Jennings in our newsroom has a question.
One, and I don't want anyone to judge you for answering it, so I will preface this by saying that I am black. What do you think Dr. King would say about where the black community, part of the black community, is in 2018? We didn't have gangs in the 1960s, not like they are now. It's a whole other thing. How would he feel based upon what he wrote, the things he said, the steps he took? What would he say to people who think that joining a gang is a good thing?
Well, I think Dr. King was, if nothing else, he was compassionate. He understood that people made choices based on their experience, their understanding of the circumstances that they lived in. And to some degree, these are shaped by the environments and the people who have influence over us. And I think that he felt that even from the earliest times, parts of the American community might extend even beyond the African-American community, were shortchanged by a lack of education, lack of economic opportunities. And those could be reflected then in the choices we make and the sort of society we create. So I think Dr. King would have had a lot of compassion for people who might make choices that don't necessarily move society in the right direction. That said, he definitely was somebody who felt like there was a right way to live, and that there was a moral life that we all had to aspire to, and that applied to everyone across the spectrum of political affiliation, affluence, and he might even argue that folks who had the control, the reins of power, the ability to make change had greater responsibility to the rest of us than the folks who are at the lower end of the economic ladder and maybe had been the victims of segregation or discrimination. I will say that that's something that I think is focused on here at the History Museum today. A lot of what we've tried to share was not just the inspiration of the I Have a Dream speech. I think our reenactment of that speech is really powerful, and Oba William King does an amazing job of bringing across the passion of that speech. But we also have the MLK Project, the Fight for Civil Rights from the Writers Theater, and that's a really powerful performance that I think digs in a little deeper into the broader spectrum of the fight for civil rights beyond just the dream speech or even King's life in general. I think it gets us to a broader collection of ideas about what it's like to be discriminated against and how challenging it can be to pursue and achieve some sort of equality in America.
John, without a doubt, Dr. King's words and ideas were so strong and so powerful and moved the African-American community so much to realize that equality should be theirs and needs to be theirs. Do you think he swayed a lot of white people back then? Do you think he took people who really believed that blacks and whites were very different people, but through his words and through his ideas, they came to see that, no, there really shouldn't be a difference between the black and white communities?
I think the critical piece of your question is the statement the back then. I think that King had an effect on people back then. I think he did have influence. I think he was lauded for the things he said and his nonviolent commitment. But I actually think that part of what we all have to recognize is that it's our commitment to those ideas since then that has made this change continue. It made the change more real. That it wasn't just that King said those things. It was that they resonated with us. And over the years, we've done things like, I mean, how many kids in America grow up and don't know what the dream speech is? Very few, I think, can go through school and not hear that speech, or at least know what it was about. Dr. King has a national holiday for him. You know, there are things that have happened over the last 50 years that have moved this forward. And I think that that's what we have to remember, is that Dr. King laid out a vision, and that he told us it was our responsibility to see it through. And I think that that's a place where obviously we have work to do. We have much left on our plate in terms of really embracing equality and realizing it. But at the same time, I do think that his impact has been not just back then, but it continues today. And I think that that's what's really extraordinary about him as an American. He has influence beyond his time.
I know you're busy today. A lot going on at the Chicago History Museum, 1601 North Clark, right here in Chicago. You can go to chicagohistory.org. John Russick on with us. Are you good on time? Can you hang on, and we'll take a quick break and continue?
I can. I'm always happy to talk about Dr. King and his time here in Chicago.
Excellent. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And we are honoring Dr. Martin Luther King today, 720 WGN.
John Russick is our guest. We're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King. It is Martin Luther King Day. John is the Vice President for Interpretation and Education at the Chicago History Museum. And, John, I want to make sure people understand about this exhibition, the museum's exhibition, Remembering Dr. King, 1929 to 1968. How long does it run for?
It's up all of 2019. So it's an exhibition of photographs and a story of Dr. King's life with a real focus on his time here in Chicago, because that is often known by few, just how significant his time in Chicago was, both as an opportunity for him to fundraise and generate money for the movement from sympathetic ears here in Chicago, but also to confront racism in the North, which was one of the roles Chicago played in helping the nation sort of think about the depth and potency of American racism in the 1960s.
When we first started talking to you, John, I mentioned that Illinois was the first state to declare Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a holiday back in 1973. First of all, is that true? This is according to Associated Press. And second of all, why was it Illinois that started this whole ball rolling?
Well, Illinois became a leader in part because of because of Chicago. There was a great deal of sympathy for Dr. King here, and he had made regular pilgrimages to the city and sought out support before protests became more the focus of his time here. When he was looking for ways to fund the movement, he was looking for people who were interested and sympathetic. But then, of course, in the 60s, he also starts to come and look at Chicago through a different lens and really get us northerners, northern cities, to come to terms with our own brand of racism and the policies and systems that have been in place for a long time to make for an unequal inequality in education, in housing, in policing, that there were all sorts of issues that he found here that he thought needed to be exposed if there was going to be real progress in America. We needed to move beyond this idea that American racism was a Southern problem. And many people have written about this issue that for a long time people in the North sort of were a little more complacent about it. They really thought racism was so much more virulent and so much more intense in the South that they, even though they might be aware of it in the North, they didn't think that it was the center of the problem. And King sort of brought that home in the 60s. And as a result, Illinois became one of those states that really became pivotal in the movement to honor him when that started in the 70s and obviously into the, I believe it's 73, is that,
yeah.
What, is that the date? Yeah, when that was first brought to national attention.
John, I saw a news piece about him once where they talked about, for all the people who loved him and who really owed him so much for changing their lives here in America, there were so many people who didn't like him and felt threatened by him, and that he was receiving death threats on a daily basis, yet he refused to live his life in fear. Can you comment on that a little bit?
I think that's what makes Dr. King so amazing. In all this time later, is when you realize that it's a really challenging position he put himself in. He was an ambassador for the idea of nonviolence at a time when there were all sorts of folks who were pushing him to embrace a more confrontational approach to demands for equality. So there were people within the movement who found him to be reluctant and maybe too sympathetic with white America. And at the same time, of course, there were elements across the spectrum of white America who thought that he was pushing too hard. He was asking for too much too quickly. And, you know, people often say if nobody's happy, then maybe you're doing the right thing. And I don't know whether that is actually true in this instance. I just think that Dr. King had a really high wire act he was walking. He knew that if he didn't demonstrate that he was having success with his approach, his nonviolent approach, his negotiated approach to solving some of the inequities, the African American community was ready for change, and maybe some within that community were ready for violent change. And he also knew that if he didn't wasn't able to remain as the effective leader of the movement, others would step forward and might. He believed that he had the best path forward, but he also knew that if he hadn't demonstrated some success with things like the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act and things of that nature, if that wasn't forthcoming, if those things didn't happen, he would be replaced as the de facto leader of the movement. So it's sort of a remarkable time, and certainly a testament to his political skills that he was able to manage both the movement and keep the progress that he was able to achieve without being supplanted at a time of great division in America.
What a great way to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You can go to chicagohistory.org or just stop by 1601 North Clark Street, Chicago History Museum. Do you have to reserve spots? Is this event free? What do we need to know?
So the museum is open today, like it always is, and it's free today for all Illinois residents and Chicago residents. So we have it's a great opportunity to come to the museum. If you haven't been here in a while, it's a great day to come and just check it out. But it's also, we've got some awesome programming going on. Like I said, there's the Writers Theater program. There's the reenactment of the I Have a Dream speech by Oba William King, and then there's all sorts of craft activities. There are things just going on all over the museum, and of course there's the exhibition, this photographic exhibition of the life of Dr. King. So we've got a lot going on today. It's going on all day, so come anytime and enjoy, and come here to remember Dr. King and his legacy here in Chicago.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, John. Greatly appreciated. Have a great day.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Russick, the Vice President for Interpretation and Education at the Chicago History Museum. Thanks, David. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder. Aaron Zorn will join us in about a half an hour. I'm not a huge proponent of violence, Wendy. And, of course, today is Martin Luther King Day, a day that we really need to examine violence and say that it's unnecessary. We can't be violent toward people. We should be nice toward each other. But when you see that video of that kid taunting the Native American, how can you not want to poke that kid in the eye a couple of times?
If I was that drummer, I would have taken my drumstick and just, you know, really, all right, so there are several different stories, and I've seen several different versions of this video, and I don't know who or what to believe, but across all those videos, one thing is for sure.
Yes.
That kid is standing, invading the personal space bubble.
With the cockiest look on his face in the history of cocky looks.
And it...
He's got this smile on his face.
A smirk.
He's honestly 2 inches from his face.
That's where, I don't know, I would have stepped forward just to kind of, don't you have close talkers at work where you kind of either step back or you step real close to them to push them back?
Right.
It was, I would have slapped him.
Nick Sandman is the kid's name. He goes to school at the Covington Catholic High School in Kentucky. Here's the story from Huffington Post. And as Wendy pointed out, there are several different versions of this story. When you first saw the video, you 100% blamed him and his group, his kids. Now, he says that they were provoked first, that the high school kids were provoked first by a third group that was there, the Black Hebrew Israelites. Here's the story out of Huffington Post. A high school student who was filmed staring down a Native American Vietnam War veteran during last Friday's Indigenous Peoples March has defended his actions, claiming that he was singled out.
Had he not been standing so close, if he was just part of that group, and I got to be honest with you, they looked like a bunch of teenage boys. They were goofing around. They were from Kentucky, I believe. They're on a trip to Washington, D.C. They're just being silly, goofy, stupid teenagers.
But they were taunting this guy, Nathan Phillips, who's the Native American, the Vietnam War vet, who was playing a song, a Native American song. They were kind of taunting them.
They were being silly and goofy. They weren't. The kid standing in front of them was the one that bugs me the most.
Yeah, Nick.
What does it rhyme with?
Yes. Nick Sandman, a student from Covington Catholic High School in Kentucky, was seen smugly, and I'm going to underline smugly 500 times.
Yeah.
Because I've seen smugly before. This kid takes it to a Hall of Fame level. Was seen smugly staring at Nathan Phillips while his peers stared down the vet as he sang the American Indian Movement song on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The teen, who was part of a group of students wearing Make America Great Again hats, said that both he and his family have received death threats following the highly publicized incident. Now, we've seen this before. You act irrationally, and then you blame everybody else for treating you poorly.
Well, no one should get death threats, Bill.
Yeah, no, I know that. He doesn't deserve death threats.
I mean, the kid's a jerk.
Right, right. But you've seen that before, right?
Yeah.
Somebody acts like a jerk, and then instead of apologizing, they tell you all the reasons.
Poor me.
Everyone was being mean to me. I had to do something.
Right.
I had to stare down the elderly Native American Vietnam War vet. What else would you do in a situation where people are being mean to you? Since going viral on Saturday, new video has emerged that provides further context to the situation, depicting members of a group identifying themselves as Black Hebrew Israelites that were shouting abuse at the students. Now that group would be different from the Native American group. Remember there was a time where several groups could be in the same place without incident?
Yeah.
Those days are gone.
Why do you have to declare which group you're in? Can't you just gather as the people?
You cannot do that anymore. Everybody needs an affiliation. While the teens do not approach the group, Phillips eventually appears and quickly becomes surrounded by the students. And he is.
Yeah, definitely.
And this kid, Nick Sandman, jerk number one.
Yep.
U.S. jerk number
Head
one.
Jerk, top jerk in charge.
Is so close to him because he maintains, Nathan Phillips, that he wanted to leave, but that Nick and others were preventing that from happening. And you can see, I mean, you could see that there was an inch away from something horrible happening, you know?
Although I just wonder, had Nathan Phillips moved forward to, like, proceed to exit,
would
what would have
them
happened?
Or not? Yeah, I know. I wonder that, too.
Because, again, stupid teenage boys acting all tough, but then when push comes to shove,
right,
I think they'd back
they
off before
in.
The shove.
However, in a statement released on Sunday, Sandman claimed that he had been singled out. He felt that as though the elder, that's Nathan Phillips, was attempting to provoke the teenagers. Did you see any of that?
No.
I didn't see any of that. I just see him. He's playing his song on the drum. He wasn't provoking them. Quite the opposite from what I saw. Phillips, on the other hand, told CNN that he was only attempting to thwart any potential violence between the two groups. I believe that by remaining motionless and calm, I was helping to defuse the situation.
What?
That according to Sandman. I said a silent prayer that the situation would not get out of hand.
Well, now there's a different story that the members of the Hebrew Israelites, it's a group of black men, those were the ones who were bothering
the teenagers.
Yeah, not Nathan Phillips, not the Native American. There was a third group involved.
Right, right, right.
And you did, one of the videos I saw, there was a woman yelling at this is a mob, and she was like provoking it. And, you know, I have a big mouth in situations like this. I think it would have been made worse had I said something. But, like, what do you do?
Who was she with?
She was a person who was there.
Yeah.
And I saw the video. There are so many videos going around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can be edited, shortened, whatever. So we see what they want us to see.
But in every video, it's no matter what the angle is, you see this kid, Nick Sandman, standing an inch and a half away from the elderly gentleman, the Native American guy, with this smirk on his face like, I know you're trying to get your song out, but I'm here.
Yeah, see, I'm not...
And maybe they were provoked by this third group. That's possible.
But that's the wrong reaction.
Why are they taking it out on this guy?
I know.
He didn't do anything.
We need... You know how they used to have a spanking machine or a dunking machine? We need a slapping machine. How could you let someone get that close to your face without, like, losing a beat and just saying, excuse me, please?
But that was his game. Like, look at how close I am to you. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Smack that smirk off your face.
And you make your little brother hit himself with his arm. it was a high school version of that. Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself?
And the school is speaking out because there was some mention of the school on one of the sweatshirts or something.
Yeah, the kids were identified right away. Covington Catholic High School in Kentucky. So the school is
they're saying they're looking into it, and there might be some things that come to the surface, including expulsion. So they're looking into it. It is just not, you know, this Catholic school, they were there for the pro-life march. That's what those Catholic kids were there for.
Right.
So I guess they're political in a way, but or did they just want to go to Washington, D.C. in the guise of, hey, we're going to do this march. Who wants to take a trip to Washington, D.C.?
Right. I don't know the answer to that.
But the look bothered me, but it was 2 inches away. I mean,
with that cocky smile.
What would you do? Listen, I've seen you. You don't get violent. But if you got somebody right in your face like that.
That would be tough to ignore.
I would punch
him.
That
would be tough to ignore. But that's what he wanted. You know, he was hoping for some sort of physicality to it. He had to be. You could just tell by the look on his face. Look at how close I am. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? He had that kind of look.
We have some phone calls on this, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break and discuss this because I don't know which story to believe.
Mm-hmm. It's very confusing.
It is.
All right, your calls, your thoughts, your texts next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. We're the kids in America.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, Martin Luther King Jr. Day today, and we were talking about this MAGA hat-wearing kid who was right in front of a Native American man, war veteran, beating his drum. There are so many videos, and there's a full hour-long video that I got to be honest with you, I didn't watch. And as we've mentioned, there are so many different stories going on this morning that we're trying to get to the bottom of it. Stacy has called us. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, guys.
What do you know about this, Stace?
Well, I mean, you're commenting on something that you didn't watch the whole video of. I did watch it this morning, and the guy with the drum, Nathan, he walks up to that group of kids. The kids kind of disperse and get out of his way, and then he's drumming right in front of that kid's face. I don't know why everyone thinks the kid provoked it, because
the kid could have stepped back.
It doesn't look like that.
And I know that there was another group that we mentioned who was bothering the Catholic boys, mainly white boys that were there. And according to the story, the Native American, Nathan Phillips, he beat the ceremonial drum and he put himself in between the two groups to break it up. But I'm sorry, that kid was right in his face. That's what bothered me more than anything.
But if you watch the video, Wendy, Nathan, the drummer, got into the kid's face.
So he was moving forward.
Correct. Please watch the videos before you guys start commenting.
Well, I've seen three videos of it, and I don't see any footage of him walking up to the boy.
And there's a video that was released.
Your email, I'll be more than happy to email you the video I saw.
And it's this is the there. One, there's one that's an hour long. Is that the one you're referring to?
It wasn't an hour long, but it probably was 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, I saw a 5 minute, a 3 minute, and a 1 minute, and in none of them do they show that. I'll look for that. I would love to see that.
It's out there now.
Yeah.
Stacy, thank you very much for calling.
Have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
And here is Ryan, who has a clearer depiction of what happened. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Good afternoon.
What'd you see, Ryan?
I watched that hour-long video, and it was taken from the colored religious. I don't want to say fanatics or anything, but they were very, very mean and disrespectful to the Catholic school kids. They're calling them school shooters. Now, there was a colored boy who was in
the term is black or African American. I got to jump in here, Ryan.
Okay, well, you know, it is what
I can't talk to Ryan.
All right.
I'm sorry.
No,
I just. Sorry. My God, it's 2019, is it not? Paul, go ahead.
Okay. Here's the deal.
Yes.
The high school kids showed up there because they were high school kids. The teacher got permission from the teachers to show up there. It doesn't matter what the kind of hat they were wearing, the clothes they were wearing, they're kids.
Right.
The African-American Hebrew group that was there started calling them incest babies. There was another camera from behind the Native American individual gentleman, Nathan, as well. That group of African-American gentlemen were calling these white kids incest babies and all these other names.
And future school shooters. I saw that.
Future school shooters, exactly. So the kids started backing up a little bit. All of a sudden, Nathan comes beating his drum. Cool. You start seeing, like, what is he now? What's he doing? And he got right, Wendy, he got right up in that kid's face. It wasn't the kid, and yes, they could have backed up, but the kid was just standing there because he was grimacing because he didn't know what to do. He had this guy.
I guess, again,
right,
stupid teenager. I guess.
Yeah, but a silly teenager. You're right. Okay. When they did an interview, CNN and Fox did the interviews, and Nathan said, I had no idea that the media was going to take this and make it look like I was a victim. He goes, all I did was step in the middle of these hateful African-American gentlemen on one side and stepping in front of these high school kids on the other side to distract both of us to what was going on. That was it. But the problem is that the media jumped on this and spun this thing into some nasty, vile garbage.
Yes.
I'm not going to swear.
All right.
And they made this kid, Nick, look like he was the one provoking it. But now all these other camera shots are out there, and the school was even threatening to expel these kids. But now that the school has seen this other video from behind Nathan, the drum player, now all of a sudden everyone's changing their tune. Oh, well, maybe we jumped. Yeah, you did jump to the gun. And I encourage you. You guys are media. I love you, by the way. I do. But we live in a day and age where there's so many different angles, and you probably didn't see it yet, but there's another video out there, Bill and Wendy, that shows that Nathan walked up to the high school students, and the high school students started chanting with them, thinking that they were doing a good thing. Now people are calling that racist.
Yes.
All comes down to that third party, the African-American group.
The Hebrew Israelites. That's their
Thank
group.
You.
So where are they when Nathan, the guy
yes.
on the drum, and Nick,
yes.
the teenage kid, when they're standing an inch and apart, where are the other guys during that part of it? Because I don't see them at all during that part
yeah.
of it.
And Mr.
So
Phillips, he clarified that it was he who had approached the crowd and that he had intervened because racial tensions primarily
yes.
between the white students and the black men were coming to a boiling point. He said, I stepped in between to pray.
The okay, it's okay. If maybe and maybe beating
that's
on the drum is his form
that
of prayer.
Song is
that.
His prayer. Yeah.
Look at if you look at a clock. Okay, at 11 o'clock you had the high school students. At 12 o'clock you had Nathan, and at 1 o'clock you had the Hebrew Israelites.
Yeah.
And while Nathan was in the middle, the Hebrew Israelites were back about maybe 20 yards from the high school students, shouting and chanting at them. they actually started walking closer to the high school students, to the point where the high school students were starting to get afraid of some of the things that they were saying, and that's when Nathan intervened. But the media, at the end of the day, and I hate to put you guys in this, the networks that took this thing and spun it only showed the part where you had Grimace
right.
and Nick, and you had Nathan beating his drum. That's all we saw.
But
at the end of the day, it was not what we thought it was, and it was actually from that other third group that was the cause of all this
stuff. Were you seeing any footage of those high school kids looking afraid? Because I didn't see a second of that.
They looked goofy, and he didn't look disrespectful. He looked smirky to me, and it bothered me that he was so close to his face. I guess if a guy is coming up with a drum, you're a teenager. At that point, you don't know what to do. Like, I'm not going to back down. I'm not.
You're right.
But he wasn't. He just had this smirk that was uncomfortable, and that was going around all night long. And Nathan Phillips did not come forward right away. So
no. And then once he saw it, Nathan will tell you in the CNN interview, once Nathan saw that, he says, I feel terrible that I did. He goes, I did not do that to, I did not feel disrespected. He goes, I only got in the middle so as to distract the Hebrew Israelites from the high school students and the high school students from the Hebrew Israelites, but more so to protect the high school students. And yes, when that knucklehead kid, the high school student, took off his shirt, I thought, what are you doing? Because it says in the interview that they got permission from their teacher to stand there and to stand for what they felt was right.
But then there's
then
also
they got spun in all this other mess. So
there's also a part,
like I said, where the kids backed off.
Where they ask one of the people, apparently there are a couple adults there to chaperone these kids, although I didn't see them. So they said that they asked if they could do their school chant, which sounds mysteriously like the American Indian chant.
Looked to me like they were mocking it. See, I saw it as they were participating and excited, and just they're in a scene and they're like chanting along. I didn't see much disrespect.
So they did get so their high school chant, no, Bill, is not similar to the Indian chant. They started doing their own high school chant. Then when Nathan was beating his drum and he was getting a little bit louder, the kids started picking up on this and they started chanting along with him.
Right.
So that's what was going on. And all of a sudden you had the high school students and Nathan chanting louder than the Hebrew Israelites, who were spewing hatred towards everybody at this point. Even other African-American men were coming up to these Hebrew Israelites, and they were being condemned by the Hebrew Israelites. They were black men were condemning other black men. It was terrible.
And
the other men were walking up to them saying, what are you doing? You're supposed to be preaching love.
Right.
And they were shooting them down. It was terrible.
Huh.
That should be the main focus on this, is that hate going on from that other group. Instead, we've got this poor high school kid grimacing. I don't know what to do. Yeah, we could tell him after the fact, Wendy. You shouldn't have been doing that. You should have done. Come on. How many times have you been in situations, guys, where this happens and you don't know what to do?
You don't know what to do. And I shouldn't say a stupid teenager, but he's an inexperienced teenager, I guess. Paul, we got
to
run.
He's going to grow up to,
No, thank you for
Thanks
the information,
for, the call,
for being clear and concise about it. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
It's Eric Zorn, everybody, from the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Eric.
Hi, how are
you? Nice to see you.
It's nice to see you guys.
I'm looking at the list of things you want to discuss. Wendy didn't see either of the football games yesterday. It was an amazing day of football.
It was one of the most exciting games, weekends of football I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That call against the Saints at the very end of the game.
The non-call?
Yeah, the non-call, the pass interference, was, I think, one of the if not the worst, one of the worst calls when you add up how obvious the actual outcome should have been, along with the consequences of that call.
Right.
Add those two together, and that was a really, really bad call. And for anybody who didn't see it, I mean, essentially it was a completely blatant pass interference that would have given the
Saints. If not more, could have been a personal foul.
Wasn't the Bears. What do I care?
I know just, a lot of people, once the Bears are out of it, I know that people do check out, but if you are a football fan and you watch those two games, exciting games start to finish in both cases, both ending in overtime.
Overtime games.
Both underdogs winning, both visiting teams winning, Tom Brady making another trip to the Super Bowl.
I you know, Tom Brady is a Michigan man like me, and so I have a little bit of an affinity for him, but I am tired of Tom Brady.
Oh, thank God. Someone else says it.
Guys.
Is this four Super Bowls in a row for the Patriots?
Give someone else a chance at life.
Third in a row, I think.
Third?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how you
his ninth overall.
How most of us tend to forget.
Yeah.
Not all of us, but right. I was like, oh, yeah, the Patriots again in the Super Bowl.
But it is tragic that a season would end, the New Orleans Saints season ended on the lack of a call with referees everywhere in a huge game. How did they not see that play?
It's unbelievable they didn't see it. And afterwards, the coach, Sean Payton, said he didn't think they would ever get over it, which is quite a striking thing for a coach to say.
They never getting over it, meaning the refs who didn't make the call?
No,
or
meaning
his
the
team?
Saints. Meaning
the Saints,
Saints
will never get over it.
I can imagine how this town would erupt if that had happened to the Bears. I mean,
horribly.
That's all we would be talking about.
Yep, so true.
You'd have to change the format of the station to just be all Bears griping all the time for
right.
several weeks. So.
Right. It would just be a loop of Ed Obradovich going, all the time.
So. But it actually brings up to me how important replay is.
Yes.
You can't do replay on a call like that. And maybe if you could, you would call pass interference all the time because it happens quite a bit. I mean, much more minor cases of it. But
holding is the one that they say if you're a football fan, there is holding on every single play.
I would believe that, yeah.
There is.
When you can get rid of the most egregious of these mistakes, the fumble before the goal line and so on, I think I love replay. People are always complaining about it. I think it's a great thing, and I had people respond. I posted on this on Facebook and people were responding saying, well, what if the human element is such a wonderful part of the game? I was like, no, it's not. Human error should not be part of the game. The part of any sport.
Tell Corey Parkey that.
The
Cody
part
Parkey.
Of the game is a physical error, not it. The whole part of the game is it's fair.
Yes.
That two teams are playing by the same rules that are fairly enforced on both sides. That's what makes sport great. If you said, okay, this team gets to have 12 guys on the field, and this team only gets to have 10, it's much less interesting.
Right.
So to have a referee influence a game. Now, there was a really terrible call, I think it was in 2011. I don't know if you remember, this is a sports geek thing, but the Detroit Tigers pitcher, Galarraga was his name, and he had a perfect game going into
right.
the, remember this? In the ninth
I do
inning,
remember
and
this.
Then there was a ground ball and to the first baseman, and he covered, they threw it. The guy was out by a step,
right.
and the first base umpire, Jim Joyce, called him safe.
Yeah.
The last out of a perfect game, and he blew it by, completely blew it. That was arguably a worse call, because that was the kind of you just got to make that call.
Right.
But it wasn't that consequential. The Tigers weren't that good that year. It didn't. A perfect game is not that big a deal. But
the umpire went out of his way then to apologize to Galarraga.
He wept. I wonder if the umpires today
there's no crying in baseball.
Or if it's football. I'm talking about.
Oh, there's plenty of crying in football.
Plenty of crying in football.
Yeah. So what about these people who a couple times a year you see this where somebody goes, we have the technology in place right now, whereas we wouldn't need umpires anymore. You could have a guy stand behind the catcher if you wanted to just to call out the outcomes, but we computer-wise would have a box, and you see it on your screen during a baseball game, where they show the ball, where it lands, if it's in the strike zone
or not.
I like that too.
And you're a tennis guy.
Yeah.
Hey, what's it called? Hawk? What's the technology in tennis called?
Oh, yeah. It is something Hawk, isn't it? Yeah.
But anyway, tennis has electronic line judges.
Where they show you where the ball
lands. Whether the ball is in or out.
To one one-thousandth of an inch accuracy.
I don't see any reason why they couldn't do that for the strike zone.
Yeah.
And just get rid of the ball and strike calls from behind the plate. And there is pushback, a lot of pushback from traditionalists on this. But you see sometimes these umpires who are, you know, letting pitches that are outside be called strikes, pitches on the corner, they're calling balls.
Yes.
I don't know, why would you perpetuate a system like that when you don't have to?
Right.
When technology makes it possible to do it. It would be easy and fast, and there'd just be no...
I wonder if the umpires union would be okay with that. Probably.
Well, you'd still need a guy behind the plate for...
But just one as opposed to four...
Oh, for every call in the field?
Yeah.
I suppose you could have one, like in kids baseball, right? You have like one umpire.
There's one umpire.
He's standing behind the pitcher.
Right.
And he calls everything.
Yeah.
And you could have video, you could have balls and strikes called by the you know, ball strike hawk, whatever you want to call it. And then you could have the plays at the bases.
If they
look at all close, the guy who's like just, I don't know. Let's look at the replay.
Right. It's easy.
It saves so much money.
All right. On to a far less pleasant story, and that is the aftermath of the Van Dyke verdict. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's a very interesting week. On Thursday, Judge Domenica Stevenson in Cook County Court acquitted the three officers who were charged with conspiring to cover up.
Right.
And Jason Van Dyke shot Laquan McDonald in 2014 and was convicted of that was it August or September when he was convicted? I can't remember when that was. It was, you know, last summer or last fall.
Yeah.
So these three officers were charged and were prosecuted on phonying up the paperwork and getting the story straight that would make it look like the shooting was justified. And so she issues this ruling. Basically, I thought it was an astonishing ruling because she essentially ratified everything the defense had said in the Van Dyke trial and in this trial, basically saying, hey, this guy could have been dangerous and we don't know what it was really like. We saw the dash cam video, but there are other angles you could see this from. She basically made it sound like this was what happened was perfectly fine and perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
And so you've acquitted these guys on that basis. And I could see where you might say, well, gee, what a coincidence it is that all the police accounts made it sound like Laquan McDonald was doing things that he was clearly not doing and that he was more of a threat than he clearly was.
Mm-hmm.
They were, and, you know, if you want to say, well, okay, memory is fallible and people make mistakes when they remember in the stressful situation, but all the stories, all of them favor the police. And how is this not evidence of a cover-up? And she just completely blew that away. I thought that was outrageous. And then the next day, Jason Van Dyke, the officer who was convicted of the shooting, and I don't know how coincidental it was that they put these back to back, but the next day, Judge Gahan, in the same courthouse, sentenced Van Dyke to essentially 3 years in prison. Now, technically, it was 81 months, which is like 6 years and
6.75.
Yeah, 6 years and 9 months. But with time served and with day for day good time, he'll be out in 3 years. So basically 3 years, which is, you know, the kind of sentence that you get for drunk driving where you kill somebody, something like that, where it's just completely a manslaughter type thing, what we would call manslaughter. And I thought that sentence was fairly low,
mm-hmm.
on the low side. He also threw out all the aggravated battery with a firearm counts that might have added up to like 96 years in prison. And it really felt, I think, like an insult to a lot of people who had been active in this case and who felt like that this was an egregious wrong, that this police officer had emptied his gun on this kid who was walking away from him. So 3 years did not satisfy a lot of people. I thought it was too low. I thought it should have been probably more like 10, 15 years for a second degree murder like that, for the kind of wound that a crime like that perpetuates onto a city. I mean, when you have police officers doing that to people, it kills the kid, but it also really damages police relations with the community, which harms law enforcement, which harms other people. It's kind of like the justification that you would give for giving Rod Blagojevich a really long sentence, and we've talked about Rod's sentence,
mm-hmm.
a lot. And in fact, I think Patty Blagojevich has been piping up again.
She's on a podcast
saying that, well, look at the light sentence that Van Dyke got compared to what my husband got. The reason that Rod Blagojevich's sentence is so long is not that he killed anybody, obviously, or even that he took money, but that he was entrusted with such power,
sure.
and he abused this power, and he the number of victims is 12 million. How many people there are in Illinois that this
still
was
too long of a sentence,
such a betrayal of trust. I know, I waffle on that because, as I said here before, if Rob Blagojevich would just say, I did wrong. I did the wrong thing. But instead, even Patty Blagojevich will come on and say like he just did what everybody else did. He didn't do anything wrong, and he's in prison. I just feel that's not the right sales tactic.
But he did do what everybody else was doing.
No, he did worse than what other people were doing. And maybe more clumsily is the term.
Right.
But in any case, to get beyond that, I mean, when you have the kind of power that Blagojevich had, when you commit a crime like that, it's worse.
Yeah.
And when you have the kind of power that a policeman has and you commit a crime like that, it's worse because you're not only just acting for yourself, you are harming the community at large. And that's why I thought that sentence was too low. I guess we're going to all have to get past it because it's done now.
But what about people said what Chicago police need is better training so that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. Is that a reality?
I think that is. And I think it's fairly widely acknowledged that having better training, more and better training is a good thing.
But is that going to happen?
Yeah,
is that just something they say?
I think it's already happening.
No, I think it is. Yeah, and they are going. You know, the circumstances under which you use deadly force, it's always under review, and I think they are shrinking those. So it's a good thing.
Eric Zorn is our guest from the Chicago Tribune. If you have something to say about it, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy WGN. Bill Lapp with Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Eric Zorn of the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about the Van Dyke sentencing. So Wendy just brought something up, that in the years that Jason Van Dyke was a Chicago police officer, this was the first time that he shot his gun while on the job. How does that enter into this, do you think?
Well, I think it certainly mitigates the idea that he was out just stalking some people to kill them, if that's the idea people have. There was some testimony at the sentencing that he had been fairly nasty to several people before that, that he had never been punished for those kinds of offenses, that he was not a guy who was officer friendly until this one incident happened. I mean, there is the argument that under a stressful situation, and there's no question that these things are happening rapidly, and you have to make split second decisions, and that the job of a police officer is really difficult. And so the argument being that in this split second moment, he made a really bad decision, that mm-hmm. he didn't have to shoot him, that there was plenty of police officers around.
Yes, he was not alone.
That the kid did not have a knife. The kid was not moving toward him to attack him.
The kid mm-hmm. did have a knife.
I'm sorry, he had a knife. He didn't have a gun. What am I saying? He had a small knife. He did not have a gun. And he was walking on an angle away from the police, and that he needed to be apprehended for sure. But the question is, do you have to unload your gun into this guy? Keep shooting him when he's on the ground. I think clearly he snapped.
It sure seems like it.
And so when you look at it that way, I think that's why you get the second degree murder conviction, which is like it was the reason that he shot was unreasonable. That he committed this crime, and he maybe had a fear, but that fear was not reasonable, which is the definition of a second degree murder. So you have a situation where this guy, I mean, I think the best term is that he snapped.
Why wouldn't they go with that as a defense as opposed to the one that they chose?
He was just doing his job.
Although I think if you're his attorneys, you're very happy with the outcome, I would imagine.
I think that the sentence they're very happy with.
Yeah.
I think there was talk that they were going to appeal the sentence. I doubt that they will. I think technically possible for the prosecution to appeal the sentence, to say because the judge wiped away too much. And the judge didn't really explain. He took a long time going through various things about the law.
Procedural things.
He sort of gave us a little seminar
on the hardships of being a judge.
Yeah, that was...
We got to hear that.
I wish I had my violin with me. I would have played it for him, a sad song. But he never really understood or explained to us why he gave the sentence that he did. He didn't talk about these balanced equities, which is that you have this guy who, like I said, I think he snapped and he committed this act, and you can't just let it go. You have to punish him, and on the other hand, there's all kinds of things you have to weigh when you're a sentencing judge, and all those things were kind of hidden from us in Judge Gahn's decision. So I wish that he had said more about that, so it's not left us to start
about how he came to
about
that particular
how he came to
the
decision
sentence.
because there's a widespread belief that what judges do in situations like this is they sort of come to the number of years they think he should spend in prison, and then they kind of take their and they figure
do the
out
math backwards.
They figure out how to do that. that. Yeah. And they've taken a lot of that discretion away from federal court judges because they have like all kinds of mandatory minimums and so on. And here what the judge did was he kind of wiped away the mandatory minimums on aggravated battery with a firearm, saying that that wasn't as serious as a second-degree murder charge. And then he was on the low end of the range for sentencing on a second-degree murder. He could have given him probation. I think this town would have been in an uproar had that happened. So,
knew that wasn't going to happen, though.
Probably, but you just never did. I mean, I was really surprised, frankly, by not just the ruling on Thursday that exonerated, but the strength, the overwhelming way in which the judge bought into the defense arguments on Thursday. That really surprised me. The acquittal didn't surprise me, but the reasoning behind it and the judge's ruling that she released really surprised me.
When Mrs. Van Dyke spoke, it was extremely emotional, just as the reading of the letters from Van Dyke's daughters. I'm not saying in this particular instance, but in similar cases, how much coaching goes on behind the scenes with attorneys where a loved one comes up and says warm, wonderful things about the person who's about to be sentenced? There's got to be some coaching going on.
You would think, although Van Dyke's statement itself, I mean, Van Dyke himself, right before he was sentenced, spoke to the court, and he basically read a short, flat, self-serving statement, which if he was coached, he needs a new coach. Yeah. It didn't make any movement. Persuasive at all.
No.
I don't know, but you should have some defense attorneys on to find out about exactly what they do. Obviously, I think these things, that they talk it through.
Yeah.
I kind of don't think that you have to, like, tell someone in the situation that Tiffany Van Dyke was in to cry. I mean, it's a very powerful
moment. It was a terrible situation.
It's heartbreaking for the family because, I mean, they didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But there were catchphrases that were repeated with the attorneys and just doing his job. That came up nonstop. So yeah. That was definitely in
a
my
theme.
Opinion. Yeah.
I would guess that there's a certain amount of coordination, and I mean, they talk this through. They know what people are going to say.
Right.
they may, in some sense, not instead of scripting it, they may have bullet points. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to have a defense attorney, you know, explain that, because I'm sure that they don't just wing it. You never know. She gets something and goes, you know, I've been thinking about it. Maybe he should
play a little more of this, a little less of this.
Or something. You know, it's like you want to make sure that what you say and what you don't want to say, too. And it might be that they said, like, don't say he did something wrong and we're asking for forgiveness. Don't say that.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, could put you into some sort of legal box.
Absolutely.
So it was quite a week.
Eric, thank you for being here. It's Eric Zorn. Read him in the Chicago Tribune or listen to the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Those are both good ideas.
Yeah. And they can find those at WGN Plus.
Yeah. Mincing Rascals every Thursday we launch. So
very good. Thanks, Eric. Coming up, the stories that matter with Dave Schwann from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio.